for It's All About Food. It's all about food, because it is all about food. Everything, I think, anyway. Health, environment, animals, everything on Earth is connected to the food we make and the food we eat, and I like talking about food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and I am the founder of a nonprofit called Responsible Eating and Living, because I think food should be not only delicious and fun and beautiful and good for you, but I think it should be good for all life on Earth. And I believe we can have our cake and eat it too. We can have great, delicious food, feed the entire world healthfully, and not do very much damage as a result, or any at all. But unfortunately, today there's a lot of crazy things going on with our food production, and it's affecting our environment in terrible ways. But there's a lot of things that we can do every day, three meals a day, if we have three meals a day, with every bite. And it can be really, really fun. So today we're going to talk a little bit about how fun it can be, especially with barbecues and summertime. It's August 22nd, 2012, and there's still plenty of summertime left for those of you on the part of the planet where it's summer in August. I know here in New York it is very much summer, and it's a beautiful day today, but there's still plenty of time left for enjoying outdoor barbecues and all kinds of fun eating and partying, and you can do it with food that's kind to you and kind to the planet. So we're going to bring on John Schlimm. He's been on It's All About Food before. He's a member of one of the oldest brewing families in the United States. He's an international award-winning author of several books, including The Tipsy Vegan and The Ultimate Beer Lover's Cookbook. He holds a master's degree from Harvard and lives in Pennsylvania. And we're going to be talking about grilling vegan style. Welcome to It's All About Food, John.
Hey, Karen. It is so exciting to be with you and your listeners again.
Yes.
How lucky I am to get to do this again with you.
Well, I am all fired up to talk about your 125 fired up recipes.
Me too. It's going to be so fun getting to add a little sizzle to summer here with you.
Yeah, well, you know, I've looked at your book and played with a few recipes. This is a winner. This is a good one. There's a lot
Thank
of
you.
Really lovely, and what I love about it is most of the ingredients are so simple. It's just a lot of beautiful, fresh, summer-grade food.
Well, you know what, with both the Tipsy Vegan and now Grilling Vegan Style, it was important to me to first create books that I call parties in a book, and parties that everyone is invited to. But also, I was determined to make these two books what I also call small town friendly, because I live back in my small hometown and I want my friends and neighbors here to be able to go to our supermarkets and our farmers markets and find all the ingredients.
I like it. And, you know, there are lots of products, fortunately, out on the market today for vegans. But in this book, you don't even have to get those special products. You can make your own vegan sour cream. You can make your own vegan mayonnaise. And also Worcestershire sauce. You have a great recipe for that, too.
Yeah, and, I think it's so important for me to blast through these silly myths that vegan eating and the vegan lifestyle is mysterious and about blah eating food and, you know, these specialty ingredients that you can only get in health food stores on Mars. You know, maybe that's the case in some books and in some places. That will never be the case in my books, because my books are all about fun and easy eating and cooking, because I really believe that the cooking should be just as fun as the eating.
Okay, so you sort out in your book talking about all the different kinds of grills that you can buy and use in order to grill. And there's a lot of choices out there.
You know, it can really be overwhelming, and that's why I try to really explain it for the beginners out there as easily as possible, and to really say you do have a lot of choices. So this is a decision that is an investment both in money, of course, but also in time and future funds. So take your time with the decision. Go shop around, see what's out there, see what you specifically need. Is this something that you're going to do in a backyard? Is this something you're going to want to take with you on the road? Or maybe you live in an apartment with just a little balcony. There are grills that fit that. There are grills that go on boats. So lots of choices. Talk to fellow grillers. Find out what they like or don't like about certain types of grills, and then you can make a decision based on that, whether you want a charcoal grill, an electric grill, a gas grill, or, you know, there are these big fancy ones out there that are hybrid grills that combine both charcoal and gas. Though those are a little pricey right now, but I think, you know, in the years to come, we're going to see those come down to a range that the rest of us can afford.
Can I ask you what kind you use?
Well, I actually like either a charcoal or a gas, and I'll tell you what, I'm currently looking for a new grill because mine has gone kaput after, you know, experimenting with all of these recipes.
Right, you burned it up.
So, you know. So, yeah, I'm going out and looking, but I'll tell you what, all my friends, you know, I love when I go to their houses, they have a variety, whether it's charcoal, gas, electric. You know, my mom has a little Foreman grill that you can fit maybe two veggie burger patties on. She loves it, you know, she plugs it in, uses it in the kitchen, and she makes stuff for herself and my dad all the time. So, again, look what you need and go out and, you know, make your choice.
Well, I think it's important to note in this book that it's a party book, and it's certainly great to go out and enjoy yourself at a barbecue, and there's all kinds of options in this book for that. But you can use these recipes indoors as well, and just for yourself.
Absolutely. And there is this amazing invention, and I would love to know who actually invented it. It's the grill pan. And it literally, and you probably have one. A lot of people might already. If not, run out now and get one. It is just a pan. It has the little ridges. You use it on the stovetop, and you might not get that smoky flavor, but guess what? That's where our imagination comes into play. But especially during the winter months, if, again, you don't have a grill or it's not easily accessible in the winter, grill pans are amazing. I use my grill pan all the time.
I've got a cast iron. It's rectangular. It goes on my gas oven burner top, and I turn two burners on underneath it. One side's for, like, pancakes, the other side's for grilling. It costs like nothing, and it's fabulous.
Yeah, it's just absolutely brilliant. So kudos to whomever out there invented that.
Okay, good. So now we've got our tools all taken care of, and now we're going to jump in and make some food. And as I was telling some people earlier, you should not be looking at this book when you're hungry. Very, very dangerous because everything is so good and tempting looking. So I just want to talk about some of the things that popped out. It's just everything. I was recently at a pizza party where we were making all these different pizzas, and one of the things that we had there were these roasted or grilled peppers, and you've got this great shishito heat wave.
And
Yeah,
no,
please.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, shishito peppers are really coming into their own. And I'm so excited that I'm getting to introduce them to, you know, the few people out there who haven't heard of them yet, but they're in most supermarkets now. And they're really this great marriage of, like, a jalapeno and a green pepper, because they're not really hot, though maybe every eighth or ninth one might be hot. But they're so good, and you pop them on a grill, and you get that brown sort of blistery effect on them, and oh, yum.
Yeah, they're really simple. This recipe that you have just uses a little oil and salt and pepper. I mean, there's really nothing to it, and yet they're beautiful, and they're really, really yummy.
And yeah, they're really a showstopper at a at a party.
Absolutely, showstopper, and they're just peppers. Yeah, I mean, that's the amazing thing about vegetables, and I think they're finally getting some of the attention that they deserve. And I just wanted to mention before we even go further that the pictures in this book by Amy Beadle Roth are really, really lovely.
Well, she is just a brilliant artist with just an impeccable eye. And she shot all of the photos for The Tipsy Vegan, which was the very first book she's worked on.
Mm.
And so it was so wonderful from my first vegan cookbook and the first book that we could sort of travel down that road together. But yes, her photos just really make the food jump right off the page and make you feel like you can reach right in and grab them. If only we could.
Yeah, you want to. You want to lick the pages here. There's no question about it. So what I like is, I mean, so many different things. You've got popcorn that you could make on the grill.
Yeah.
Why not?
I really wanted to push the limits with this book. I couldn't believe that there had not been a vegan grilling cookbook done before. There have certainly been a few vegetarian ones done, but even those leave out a chunk of us that can't enjoy all of those dishes. So I really, wanted to put a book out there that was going to break some new ground and contribute something to this whole wonderful discussion we are having to move it forward. So to put recipes like the popcorn in there, and another one that's getting a lot of buzz from people on Facebook and Twitter, the tattooed watermelon salad.
Oh, I was going to bring that up. Yeah. Yeah.
They were like, what? You can put watermelon on a grill?
Yeah, we were just talking about that before the show started. Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's another really simple recipe. And, my thought process is you can put anything on a grill at least once and try it. And, maybe not everything works, but, boy, we found a lot of things that do work, like the watermelon, like the popcorn, peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Finicky little eaters, and especially now with back to school, maybe not everyone's so excited about back to school. I have a back to school party for your little ones and, grill up some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
I know. I haven't made it, but I was just thinking, just having that gooey peanut butter melting in your mouth it just sounds so good.
Yeah, another showstopper. And guess what? The adults will like it just as much as the kids, because isn't that one of the ultimate comfort foods, that peanut butter and jelly sandwich?
I'm looking at the romaine holiday, which is all of these, most of them are really simple. And this is just romaine leaves that you haven't prepped really very much. It's just the long, almost like you cut a head of it in half or something like that. And then you sprinkle it with some really great flavorings. But I like this for a lot of reasons. One is sometimes when I go to a restaurant, I order a salad like this because as a vegan, that way I know that I can see all the ingredients. I know that they haven't put anything in it that might be suspect. But I could imagine for a picnic or an outdoor party, this is like terrific because when you don't cut up the lettuce ahead of time, it really holds its own. It stays muscly. It's just a lovely way. The presentation's great. People don't think about this, but this is a good one.
No, and I am all about easy entertaining. I love to entertain as much as the next person. But I think you realize this, because I'm sure you entertain a lot. The host and hostess so often is stuck in the kitchen having to do all the work while everyone else is, in the other room or out in the backyard having all the fun. So to have dishes that are easy, especially like the romaine holiday, what a great luncheon dish if you're having a few people over for lunch. You can easily prepare it and, really spend the time with your guests and not in the kitchen or at the grill.
You have a string bean and arugula salad, and you say that you can use yellow or green beans, but the yellow beans really pop in this recipe with the arugula, and I was really surprised to see that. It's gorgeous. Go yellow beans.
One of a million different things that I love about working with vegetables, and of course there's a lot of fruit that we'll talk about that mm-hmm. you can grill as well. they really are works of art. I mean, no artist on the planet comes close to Mother Nature when she is creating these beautiful fruits and vegetables for us to work with. You know, the work's already taken care of for us as far as making these plates look beautiful. We are just sort of the middle person preparing them and putting them on the plate. But that dish, it really is a great example of just how beautiful, and again, simple and beautiful that a dish can be.
Yeah, I don't know why anybody would choose a beef burger, a turkey burger, a crappy Frankfurter over some of these gorgeous recipes that you have in here. But some people will. What is a cedar plank?
Well, it is really just what it says. It's a piece of cedar that has been prepared, and you can certainly get it in a specialty store.
Like a specialty food store, or what kind of specialty store?
Well, I've seen them in specialty food and kitchen stores that you can, you know, that's one of those things where you may have to look around a little bit for, but it's really worth it because that comes with the cedar smoked mushroom recipe in the book. And certainly once you use it on that recipe, I'm sure you'll find other things that you can also use that cedar plank.
So it's just a piece of cedar wood?
Yes.
Like the kind I would use in my closets to keep the moths out.
Yes, more or less, but a different purpose.
Good. I like multi-purpose things. And then the other really interesting ingredient, which is brilliant in this recipe, is the mushroom crust. Did you come up with that, or you see it? Well, I've never seen that before.
Well, you know, I, over the course of, I think this is cookbook number 9 or 10 for me, I've really developed a great team that I work with, and every cookbook author does this, and a really great test kitchen, because naturally these recipes need to be tested and sampled, and, you know, I think people have the luxury of walking into the bookstore and, oh, there's this great cookbook, just going to buy it. A lot goes into it. And so I really worked closely with my team, and we developed this recipe. And again, pushing the limits to give people not only simple, delicious food, but a few things in there that they might not have heard of before. And the mushroom crust is certainly one of those. And it's something that you can use with other things once you try it once with this recipe. You can have some fun.
Yeah, well, all it is dried mushrooms that you pulse and make a coarse ground of in a food processor. And I imagine mushrooms have so much flavor. And just sprinkle. I'm just so excited to try this.
Yeah, mushrooms, I think, are so underrated among vegetables. And they're one of my favorites, and there's so many different kinds. And boy, you can have so much fun experimenting with them. And certainly, you know, those people out there who have trained themselves to go out and pick wild mushrooms, which you do need to be trained to some degree, because there are some out there. And that's one of my goals, to learn exactly how to do that. But think about, you know, using some of those delicious wild mushrooms.
Well,
maybe find someone who does that and ask them if you can have some.
Let's just take a moment here and talk about the mighty mushroom, because I remember people thinking that there wasn't really anything of nutritional value in a mushroom, and mushrooms are amazing. I like to call them natural chemotherapy sometimes, because there are so many immune system boosting things in mushrooms and anti-cancer fighting things that people are now starting to take. Concentrated mushroom supplements, not the ones that we eat, but other mushrooms. But all of the mushrooms are really packed with really good stuff. So eat up.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we as a society feel that we need to load down our food, specifically vegetables, with all these different sauces and butters and seasonings. And you know, of course, some of that can be really good, but I love to just take a raw or lightly cooked vegetable and just have sort of a mindful moment where I pop it in my mouth, I chew it, I close my eyes, and I really concentrate on the flavor. And I think if you do that with a mushroom, even with, you know, corn on the cob does not need all this butter and salt and all that slathered on. I put nothing, you know, and I have two grilled corn on the cob recipes in the book that have really great sauces, but I often love just eating it as is. And when you really focus on the flavor just as it is without anything on it, you're going to be surprised. You know this, I know this, I'm sure a lot of your listeners do. You're going to be so surprised at how flavorful these vegetables are.
Corn can vary depending on where you get it and what farm and what time of the season it's from, but I picked up some corn recently from our brand new farmer's market in my neighborhood, and I thought, did they add sugar to the soil? This corn was the sweetest thing I had ever tasted. It was crazy.
We just had corn from, you know, we're at the pinnacle of our farmer's market here, because, of course, we have a very short growing season in Pennsylvania here, but we just had corn from our farmer's market on Sunday at a picnic, and I thought the same thing. I'm like, this is like candy.
Sugar,
and again, all on its own. You did, and what was great is, you know, of course, I don't use butter anyway. But the others around the table, my cousins and aunts, and even my parents, who always have to slather up their cobs and everything, they forgot to bring the butter out. And I said, just try it without anything on. They couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe it. They ate it without any butter or anything else. But you're right. Corn is one of those things. Sometimes you can get corn that is really, really bad. So, you know, if you get a bad cob, don't judge corn on that one cob.
Right, yeah. But definitely eat it when it's fresh and in season. And speaking of fresh and in season, let's just talk a moment about tomatoes, which should only be eaten fresh and in season. Unfortunately, I talk probably too much about tomatoes from time to time, but they grow tomatoes all year round in Florida, and they have no flavor, and they're grown really horrifically. And the thing is, catch them when they're in season, eat as many as you can, and then move on to something else.
Absolutely, which of course, you know, brings me, and I'm sure you, to my grilled tomato son's recipe on page 78 of the book. Super, super easy. Cut the tomato half crosswise, scoop out the seeds and some of the pulp, and then just with a little salt, a little pepper, some olive oil, put it cut side down on the grill for a few minutes, and you have an amazing, amazing, simple dish. Side dish, a little luncheon dish, whatever you want. Right now, of course, the tomatoes are really in season, and we're just enjoying them by the mouthful from the farmer's market and from all different relatives whose gardens are overflowing with them. If people don't understand the difference in taste, I challenge them, have one in season, and then, you know, in January, find one, and you're going to notice the difference big time.
I used to live in the south of France, and this was a dish that you found in many restaurants, and I would make it at home a lot, but it's just so simple and just amazing. Grilled tomatoes.
And talk about health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Tomatoes. Oh, my goodness. We just keep learning about those, don't we?
Okay,
amazing.
So we just have a few minutes left, so let's go to the sweeter side. And I think most people don't realize that they can grill fruit and how spectacular it is.
It really is. We talked about the watermelon, which is fantastic, but strawberries and peaches. There is the party on South Peach salsa in the book, which so yummy, but just peaches grilled on their own and combined with a great sauce. Different berries, even other than strawberries, you can grill. Coconut recipe in the book. Pineapple rings. It just goes on and on again. And if you find some fruit that is strange and mysterious, you pick it up and toss it on the grill. Put a little oil and just throw it on the grill and go with it. And, you know, I think a lot of this is about experimenting and having fun. And especially with grilling, every grill is different, so you need to stick close by. But you can have so much fun transforming dishes. And I like to think with grilling vegan style and the vegetables and fruit dishes in there, it's just a starting point.
Have you heard this? I just want to ask you, have you heard this? I heard that when you... The first bite of anything you eat is the one that's the most flavorful, and then as you continue to eat it, you don't get all of the flavor of that first impression. And I've read it many times, and I don't believe it, because when I'm eating delicious fruits and vegetables, every mouth is spectacular. And I'm wondering, is it just because I have a clean palate, and maybe this is true of people who are eating all the wrong things, that the first bite is only interesting, but every bite of a good grilled vegetable or any of these things is spectacular.
Well, I have to say and admit that I am a great observer of the way people eat, which I shouldn't say, because now anyone at a dinner party with me is going to be very self-conscious. But if you've ever noticed, most people, it's no wonder the first bite is the only bite they taste, because, you know, 5 minutes later, they're done. They just, I don't think they even chew anymore. Mm. They just gulp it and swallow it whole.
Good point.
I'm always the last one done. I always chew my food, which really is the healthy way to do, because our stomachs don't have teeth. You know, so I think you and I are, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are very mindful eaters and really appreciative of what they're eating and really the flavor and where it came from. And eating to me is almost an exercise in meditation sometimes. But yeah, I think people need to slow down and make every bite count and really be grateful for that bite of delicious food that they're having. And the flavor will then follow.
John, thanks for joining me on It's All About Food. I really love what you've done with fruits and vegetables. Spectacular. Grilling vegan style. These recipes really are fired up and worth celebrating.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to do it again with you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for joining me. I'm going to take a break now. That's what I'm doing. And we'll be right back with Jenny Brown from the Woodstock Animal Sanctuary. And she's got a really beautiful story to tell in her new book, The Lucky Ones. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And I talk all the time about food, about how plant foods can be delicious and literally save your health, save your life. I talk about the environment and how factory farming of animals is so devastating. But there's one real reason why I talk about eating plant foods. And I don't talk about this real reason all the time, but the real fundamental reason is because of the horrific cruelty that goes on every day to innocent animals. That's really what drives me. And there are people, more and more people are doing more to help these innocent, precious beings. And I want to bring somebody on the show today who is doing more than most. And she's come out with a great new book. Jenny Brown is the co-founder and director of the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary, a not-for-profit organization and farm animal shelter. She's a vegan animal rights activist and previously worked as a television producer until 2002. She's the author of a new book, The Lucky Ones. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you so much for having me on, Karen.
Thank you. And, you know, I just finished reading the book, and everyone needs to read this book.
Well, thank you.
Everyone needs to read it. You know, there's a number of key books that have come out over the last 25 years, I think, that talk about animals and factory farms and why we need to eat plant foods. Some of them have been groundbreaking and others have not been so good, but the people have been motivated to write them, and this is one of my favorites.
Well, thank you so much. It was an incredible opportunity, first and foremost, to be a voice for farm animals.
Well, you have a really special story. And there's a number of elements that make your book unique and powerful.
So obviously one is where you share this intimate story about your health as a child.
Right.
And the bone cancer that caused you to lose a leg. Very profound. That grabs everyone's attention right away. But and then you tell this beautiful story, and then you really get to the hard issues. It's a string that works really beautifully. But there's something that I've been thinking about reading the book, and that is we are so much more than our bodies. And it's not just humans, but we're always judged by our physical vehicle. And
right.
It's the same with animals. They are more than their bodies. They're more than what we see.
Right. And in this case, it's about making the invisible visible. Because I think people very easily look at their dogs and their cats and see them as individuals with personalities, or if you believe in souls, you know, you assign that to your companion animals as well. But, you know, it's all about trying to raise awareness and taking a look at farm animals and questioning how we are able to justify the divide that we create in our culture and in our consciences. And, you know, we look at Korea and we just are disgusted by their consumption of dog meat.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to take a look at ourselves and realize, really, when you ask yourself, can you, in an articulate and informed way, tell me the fundamental differences between farm animals and companion animals? And I think if people are faced with that, you know, you get those who consider themselves religious and that might adhere to doctrines in their written book. You know, those who use that as an excuse and really believe that those books are the Word of God, you know, that's a valid excuse, but
I don't know if it's valid.
It's culturally, a valid excuse.
Mm-hmm.
But the sad thing is, you know, I grew up Southern Baptist, and these scriptures that talk about the consumption of animals have been interpreted and rewritten by man, you know, for centuries and centuries. So there's translation that's lost in there.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of scholars who can debate the scriptures and talk about how you can take other meanings from those scriptures. So, you know, to evolve morally and consciously and sustainably as a planet, this is the next evolution.
Absolutely.
We have got to look at how we treat the animals we eat, which are, and the importance of it is because this is the most number. Farm animals are the largest group of beings. They consider us all beings. They're the largest group of beings that are exploited and slaughtered and confined and who live miserable lives. The most number of animals that are affected are farm animals, and that's why my passion is to try to raise awareness and lift the veil off of animal agriculture that many of us consciously refuse to even peek under.
Yeah, it definitely is a veil. But I'm not a religious person, and so
I'm not any longer either. I mean, I consider myself spiritual.
Absolutely.
I do like to because honestly, I can't believe in a God that would allow us to mistreat the other living beings on this planet. And, you know,
yeah, when you look
to
at
me,
it that way,
our dominion is a self-appointed dominion.
Absolutely.
And, you know, our self-appointed dominion has led to oppression and moral bankruptcy when it comes to sharing the earth with other animals.
You know, we know that the Bible was used to make excuses for human slavery for a long time. And now most of us know that's not a good thing, even though there are many people that are still enslaved in one way or another, unfortunately. Humans can do very cruel things. But if we're going to go with religion, go to the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. I always ask, what does that really mean? Does that mean we shouldn't kill people we don't like, or we shouldn't kill white people or black people or men or women, or how about anything?
No, I mean, don't you want to, for those who believe in a God, whether it be Allah or Jesus Christ or Buddha or whoever, wouldn't you want your God and the reason you're following that God to be a compassionate God? Now take a look at factory farms and animal agriculture in general. Are your beliefs really in line with your values? I mean, that's what I, you know, that's just one part of this. And we've started out on a really serious note here. But the book really goes into the various issues in agriculture. And I don't just talk about factory farms. There's inherent cruelty and suffering on the small local or organic, which, by the way, has nothing to do with animal welfare, or whatever, one of these happy meat farms. You know, not only is humane slaughter an oxymoron, we're taking their lives to satisfy our taste buds, and there's really no other way to say it. And there's a wonderful animal sanctuary in Australia, and the woman who started that organization puts on her T-shirts, which I think is just so well said. If we can live happy and healthy lives without causing harm to others, why wouldn't we? And to do it with gratitude.
Yep.
Wouldn't we rather be a peaceful people and extend that peace and that circle of compassion to all living beings? Violence begins on our plate, and it has a it trickles out. If we can acknowledge the violence that we are a part of every day in terms of our food choices, perhaps that could be a starting point for looking at violence in other aspects of our lives and in the world in general.
Well, you've had that epiphany. I've had that epiphany. And we know many others who have, and yet there are still many more who haven't. And it's that challenge to find that one key to lift the veil on each person, which can be really mind-boggling to me.
Well, it's not easy because we are so disconnected as a society from how these animals live and die. We never see them. Here at the sanctuary, you know, they're no longer abstractions for me. I'm with them every day. I am with the victims I am fighting for. They are not abstractions. But in the public mind, they are abstractions. Unless you live in Iowa and you live down the street from some big old farms, usually feedlots, factory farms, oftentimes people even that live in these states where there is an abundance of animal agriculture, you would pass by massive factory farms that are housing tens of thousands of animals and never even know there are animals inside.
Yep.
Because it is completely hidden from public view. And it's time for us to demand that we see inside of these places and that we strip the power from big agriculture that just bombards us with images of dancing happy chickens that are going to be eaten and people having a good time and high-fiving while they're chomping down on a burger and the chicken McNuggets and the bacon. And why isn't bacon called dead pig fat? You know, I mean, we even have
I don't know if it would have mattered to some people.
Maybe not, but what does matter is how disconnected we are.
Yeah.
And I often talk about this because I grew up watching Little House on the Prairie. I loved that show. And oh my God, when Pa would cry, my mom would immediately break out into tears. Pa was such a sensitive man. And, you know, I remember an episode where Pa, they loved their animals and they, you know, this can be, of course, debated, but they raised their animals with care and compassion. They gave them the closest thing to a normal life that they could have. But then sometimes the the dairy cow would have to be slaughtered so that they could feed themselves through the winter. Mm. Gone are those days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we pay somebody else to do the dirty work in terms of looking an animal in the eye and slashing their throat,
you know,
or putting a gun to their head. It is, I mean, this is why I often also talk about how science fiction it is. It's all done in these massive industrialized factories,
and we
are so disconnected.
You've probably seen the illustrations by Sue Coe in her book Cruel, but it looks so sci-fi, and you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, Sue Coe is amazing. Of course, I've got Dead Meat and Cruel, the recent ones, and it's heartbreaking. And for those who, you know, refuse to see with their eyes what these animals are enduring, perhaps even just looking at illustrations where you're not looking at graphic photographic images, you know, at least look at the drawings of somebody who was allowed inside and was able to take sketches of what she was witnessing.
Now, speaking of allowed inside, you did some undercover work before you created your sanctuary, and you went inside and saw some of the horrific things that happened at a number of different slaughtering facilities in Texas.
No, it actually wasn't slaughter facilities. These are stockyards.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Right. And so stockyards and auctions are almost synonymous. But basically, you know, they're out in rural areas. I spent a week. I was sent out there back in 2002 to get into stockyards and document downed animals, which are those animals that are too weak or sick to stand. They're non-ambulatory. So at the end of the day, when the slaughterhouse trucks come, you know, some of those animals end up leaving and going to other farms. For instance, the veal calves. The, you know, my very first day that I was there, one of the very first things I witnessed was a whole truckload of veal calves being unloaded from a local large-scale dairy operation. Some of them were still slick from their mother's birth, umbilical cords hanging, limbs that had been pulled from the joint from being yanked out of their mother's womb or being rough-handled to get them onto the truck. Many of these little guys could hardly walk into the pen, so they're dragged by their ears, they're dragged by a leg, they're kicked, electric prodded, and their babies. And really, it was at that moment I said to myself, I have just witnessed the exact reason why I can no longer say, oh, but I love cheese, and what's wrong with cheese? You know,
few people make that connection between the veal calf and dairy products.
Well, I've been vegetarian for a long time, but I was just exposing myself to the atrocities of the dairy and egg industry, which now here at Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary, when we do tours, we talk about how there's actually more suffering in the dairy and egg industry than there is in just eating a chicken or a steak. And I know that's bizarre, but in this country, again, another thing people don't realize is that there are different breeds that are used for dairy than from the breeds that are used for meat. Same thing with the chickens. There are commercial egg layers, and then there's commercial broilers, which are the ones that are so genetically manipulated they grow to a profitable slaughter weight at 45 days of age and therefore have all sorts of debilitating problems once they live beyond that slaughter age and weight. So, you know, I mean, this is, even my husband, you know, so many people come up from New York City and visit here, and they didn't even realize that cows have to become pregnant and produce a calf in order to produce milk, yet we're mammals and our bodies act the same way, you know. It kind of makes sense, but it needs to be laid out for you. These are not things we talk about in school at all.
I know we need to get
comes from cows,
that. We need home economics and back in the schools, maybe updated a bit, but people don't know where their food comes from. They don't know how to make food. They know so little.
What classroom is saying, in order for us to drink the breast milk of a cow, there's a calf that's not allowed to drink her breast milk, which was by nature intended for the calf. And each calf, year after year, is torn from her, from her heartbreaking bellows. So, and that little calf either goes and lives in a fiberglass hut if it's a female, and she will later replace her mother on the dairy line. And all the boys, oh, you think veal is terrible, and oh, I know you haven't eaten veal in 20 years because that comes from a baby. But do you not realize that every time you choose to have milk in your coffee, a yogurt, which is supposed to do the body good, you know, a piece of cheese, do you not realize that that's exactly what you're supporting?
I'm kind of curious.
It's heartbreaking.
I'm curious about that veal campaign that happened maybe 20, 30 years ago that moved people so much to not want to eat veal, and yet they don't realize what goes on with any other animal to the same degree.
I don't know whether or not there were mention in those campaigns that try to get people to take a look at where veal even comes from, and that veal is a byproduct of the dairy industry. Of course, these animals, these precious calves, shouldn't be considered a byproduct, no more than animals should be called commodities or livestock. But using these terms to apply to these animals, you know, it makes people aware that, anyway, that, you know, we use these terms, even in the animal rights movement. These are the unwanted male calves that were born to the dairy cows only in order for us to drink her milk. No, it's not true that a dairy cow produces, you know, has one calf and then produces milk forever. She's impregnated to keep her productive. She's impregnated year after year. I don't think those were issues that were even raised in the veal campaigns, because I think the strategy was trying to get people to focus mostly on crated veal.
Right.
And I don't know the percentage off the top of my head. There are some veal operations that serve more of the finer restaurants of New York City who love to tout their humane, sustainable, grass-fed BS.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's these animals that are coming from those places. But by and large, veal comes from a male baby calf who lived his entire 6 months of miserable life in a crate and fed a diet that kept him borderline anemic to constitute the very pale, tender flesh that typifies veal.
I've been hammering lately on this concept, which I think is really important, and that's the big picture. People need to understand the big picture. So I appreciate people that go out and protest specific issues, circuses and fur and not eating this and that and making cages bigger, et cetera. But for me, it's the big picture. Humans need to evolve and get to a higher consciousness.
Absolutely, in so many ways, but especially in this way, where we refuse to even look at it. I just wonder, you know, I mean, for myself, I couldn't respect myself. I couldn't live with myself knowing what I know now and continuing to support the violence, the misery, the cruelty of animal agriculture. And I'm not trying to call people bad. It's really the USDA and, you know, the FDA and Big Ag and our politicians who allow money to be, you know, funneled into their pockets by Big Ag and, you know, that are promised lucrative jobs once their term is over. You know, it is a broken and corrupt system. And that's where it needs to begin, and demanding that we have education in the classrooms about these issues, and that we pull the subsidies from the meat and dairy industry and give them to the vegetable and fruit farmers and the seed and the nut and the grain farmers, and focus on optimal health for humans, not the quickest, fastest buck, not the good old boys clubs, but what is optimal nutrition for animals. And as I've said a number of times, and you've heard it said as well, something is wrong when it costs more to buy a head of broccoli than it does to get a full-on soda, french fries, and Big Mac at McDonald's. Something is wrong.
Well, we're living in a truly B-grade sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any
sense
at all. A horror
film. Science fiction horror film.
Yeah. You know, I do blame our government and the subsidies and the policies that we have, but the only way it's going to change is with individuals making informed choices. And, you know, people say, oh, I would do it if it was easier, if there was more. No, it doesn't get easier. You make it a priority. And then when you shift your perspective, it becomes easy. When I walk into a supermarket, most of the things I see, I don't consider food.
Oh, right. It's so heavily processed. We dump corn syrup into everything. We produce all this crappy corn that's really intended to feed the animals we call livestock. You know, when people are starving, 60 million people every year, and when we're turning a third of the world's grain supply, in the United States it's higher, it's 65 to 80, depending on if you're talking from, you know, soybeans primarily, but worldwide a third of the world's grain supply goes to feed animals that are society calls livestock. And that's what is happening, and then people often attack animal rights activists and say, why don't you take that energy and focus it on human causes? Well, guess what? We are, and we're trying to tell you that you can help those human causes as well just by making more compassionate, healthier, sustainable choices three times a day when you sit down to a meal.
It's very obvious to me that people moving toward a plant-based diet, that's really the only solution we have on this planet.
Right.
But it's just very obvious to me that any time there's opportunity for profit, there's opportunity for exploitation. And I just wanted to touch on one more bad news story, and then I want to get to some good news. And that's,
yay, good news!
The sheep that are grown for wool. I remember reading about them a really long time ago when I made my choice to go vegan, and reading in your book reminded me and actually added some more horrific details that go on with sheep that are sheared.
Mm-hmm.
The most horrific part, I guess, was the image I had of what they do to their backsides.
Right. It's mulesing, and it's not done in every country, but Australia, where I think it's 40% of the world's wool comes from there, and a lot of it is merino, which is so popular. Mm-hmm. And it's specifically the merino sheep that, you know, think of a Shar Pei dog. And so there's all these layers and folds of skin. When you stretch that out, that's more product. That's more coverage. So they came up, well, sheep eat grass. They are ruminants. And the cheapest way for a farmer to feed his sheep is to have large swaths of land. In this country, we do a lot of wildlife killing so that we can deforest, open the fields to feed the cattle or the sheep or whatever, and so they're allowed to graze. So they eat mostly grass. What we do here, because we can't offer them grass year-round, we supplement hay every day. That's not economically feasible for a farmer to do that. It just doesn't make economic sense. So what they do is they rotate them. They'll eat down a pasture, down to the ground, and then they move them to another pasture. When you do that, oftentimes sheep will get a little diarrhea because there's moisture content in the fresh grass, and instead of pooing the pellets, they'll have some runny poo. Sorry, I could use fancier words. Runny poo.
It's runny good.
Poo.
Descriptive.
And then what happens then is they get what's known as fly strike. Flies will come. They're attracted to that runny poo. Flies will lay their eggs in the runny poo, and then they get what's known as fly strike, where basically maggots will start eating their back ends away. And it ruins the wool. It can make the sheep, of course, very sick. They just see them as a production unit. It's not about the welfare of the animals. They want the wool, and eventually they're going to sell the lambs and the older sheep for meat regardless. So what they created was this very cruel technique called mulesing, where they flip each, once a lamb, I think, is about 6 to 8 months old, to prevent this problem of fly strike, they flip them over, tie their legs together, take what looks like the equivalent of crude garden shears, and basically cut the skin off of their rear ends. But, you know, if it were us, it's basically like they're cutting off all the skin that covers our butt cheeks, our buttocks. They do that so that it's going to scar tissue over, create a smooth surface, so that when it rains or if they're sprayed off, they can easily get that poo off instead of it getting embedded in their wool.
That's pretty horrible. But you know what? We have two more minutes left, so I want to talk about the wonderful Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary. Now, your website is...
I only have 2 minutes to do that.
Yeah, anyway, woodstocksanctuary.org, woodstocksanctuary.org is paradise for for some very special lucky ones.
They're the lucky ones, and I consider myself to be a lucky one as well, from surviving cancer to working in film and television for a decade and then really finding out what my true passion is. And it's not about me. This book isn't an ego trip for me. It talks a lot about me and my personal journey, which is what the publishers were interested in. You know, I'm the kooky girl from Kentucky that grew up in a Southern Baptist family, lost my leg to cancer as a child, had a cat that really opened my eyes to, wait a minute, it's animals have souls too, and then sort of my journey to from doing undercover video work to founding the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary with my wonderful husband Doug, and the work that we do here and my philosophy about our relationship to farm animals. We are open on the weekends. We're 23 acres with 200, typically around 200 beautiful rescued farm animals that are friendly and happy, and they behave very differently than if they would be treated as a commodity. They have names, they have personalities, they're seen and treated as individuals, and sanctuaries have the unique opportunity of bridging that gap where people are looking animals in the eye that they only know as food, and they begin to see them as an individual. And when that moment happens, we also tell those people in the most effective way we can, without alienating anyone, how millions of other animals just like them are living and dying to make their way onto our plates.
Thank you, Jenny Brown, for joining me on It's All About Food. Thank you for writing your book, Lucky Ones, My Passionate Fight for Farm Animals. It's a great, great read, and everyone should read it. Thank you again.
Thank you, Karen.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Please go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, for more on how to evolve to a plant-based diet for health, environment, and certainly for the animals. Have a delicious week.